Climate change will rearrange the forest landscape in your lifetime in ways you will hardly recognize. This is already happening. Last summer, I went to a favorite campground on a lake in the woods, Lightning Lake, in the famous Manning Park of British Columbia. But there was some mistake. The lake was naked and exposed, with the formerly wooded campsites looking like a Safeway parking lot. The pine bark beetle, brought on by climate change, had killed so many pines that park staff felt obligated to cut them all down before they fell over or burned in a conflagration. Forest planners in BC doubt that our parks will protect the ecosystems they enshrine. As the planet heats up, even by 2050, some forest companies will have grasslands in their tenures instead. Trees formerly found in the south will migrate north, but they won't be able to keep up with climate changes. Instead, we may have invasive species and scrub. We'll hear about these rapid changes in the forests of British Columbia in our feature speech this week on Radio EcoShock. And if you live outside BC, this longtime government forester will give you a lot of clues of what you can expect in your forest or state as the climate change ramps up. We taped this presentation at the 6th North American Forest Ecology Workshop, held at the University of British Columbia. On June 19, 2007, Dr. Del Meidiger of the BC Ministry of Forests and Range explained what the government expects to happen to our forests with climate change, and a few ideas of what we should be doing about it. If you listen closely, the situation is shocking. Whole ecosystems will morph, die, and march to new locations. It is safe to say that modern humans have never seen anything like it. We all tend to unconsciously locate ourselves by the big structures of nature, the trees. When these change or disappear, we feel dislocated ourselves. The impact of climate change on the forests of the world is one of the underreported stories of our times. Dr. Del Meidiger has worked as a forest ecologist for almost 30 years in British Columbia and in Southeast Asia. He has steered the development of the forest ecosystem classification in BC. And now, he urges extreme caution in our planning, just because the future of the forest is so unpredictable under climate change. From the Forest Ecology Workshop, here is Dr. Del Meidiger.
Okay, you've seen the map. This is the biogeochromatic zone map of British Columbia on the left. And then on the right is what the climates could look like in 2080, so in the 2080s. And that's based on some work that was done recently by Andreas Hamann and Tong Li Wong, where they modeled a certain emission scenario into the future. They took the climate envelopes, which they named by our biogeochromatic zones as climatic zones, and then projected them into the future. So this is one possibility of the future. It isn't the only one. Just have a look, though, at a few things. Like this green zone here, the coastal temperate rainforest, restricted to the coast, of course, at this point in time, increased quite substantially in the future, mostly because the subalpine zone above it is strongly driven by snow and temperature, and with temperatures rising, the coastal western hemlock climate sort of takes over more of that area. Again, you could look at, say, this northeastern part of British Columbia. It's part of the boreal forest, what we call the boreal white and black spruce zone. And you can see there's not much blue left in the future under this scenario. It changes to a climate more similar to ponderosa pine and interior Douglas fir type forest. And you can also just see, I'll just point out one other thing, just this red zone here, which is pretty restricted to the valleys of the Thompson and Fraser, expands quite dramatically, and that's the grassland zones. So there's a lot of change possible in the future. So this one is showing relative increases in precipitation, summer precipitation, because that's what drives a lot of growth of our forests and other plants. And so you can see from the 2020s to the 2050s to the 2080s, the orange is showing a significant increase in precipitation, or decrease, in the southern part of the province, but an increase in the north. And one of the things, though, is that although a lot of the models are fairly good on temperature, everything, they're pretty consistent no matter what model you look at, for precipitation, there's a lot of range. So this sort of, we're showing here sort of a 15 or 20% decrease in precipitation, but models have shown from zero up to 40 or 50%. So we have these changing Beck climates, and some zones are changing completely in as short of a span as less than 50 years. So if you look at the 2050s at this kind of modeling, certain zones, the ponderosa pine is PP, there's the subboreal spruce zone, which is the big zone in the center of the province, and the boreal white and black spruce are pretty much changing completely, like over 90% of them are changing to some other type of climate. And the zones that pretty much stay as is and even expand are the Coastal Douglas Fir Zone, which is on the interior of Vancouver Island and a little bit on the mainland, on the east side of Vancouver Island here. The Coastal Western Hemlock Zone, these temperate rainforests, the green one as I mentioned, and then the Bunchgrass Zone, that red one. So what does that mean when you're losing, say, when the climate of a zone is changing totally? Well, we'll take a few examples and have a look at that. The Ponderosa Pine Zone, as I mentioned, is one that changes completely. And what it changes to is a bunchgrass-type climate. So as it gets hotter, you know, you're going to lose, the trees are going to have a harder time surviving and the grasslands kind of take over. But there's some similarity between these zones. It's not, you know, a black and white thing. 65% of the species, if you just looked at total species, that are in the Ponderosa Pine Zone are also in the bunchgrass zone. So there's a lot of overlap in that. But also, I calculated some similarity values, and this just takes into account not only presence or absence of species, but also how abundant they are. And so if you take that into account, they're about 55% similar between those two zones. So even though it looks maybe shocking, it's maybe not quite as shocking. The subboreal spruce zone, by the 2050s, only 5% of that area is still in a subboreal spruce type climate. The rest of it is changing pretty much to Douglas fir, an interior Douglas fir, or the interior cedar hemlock type climate. But again, there's some similarity between those zones. The interior cedar hemlock is about 55% similar to the subboreal spruce, and the Douglas fir is 35% similar. Wetlands, the values differ a little bit. More similar wetlands in the interior cedar hemlock to the subboreal spruce zone. But if you look at adjacent areas, I mean, this is looking at the whole zone, and some of those zones are fairly large. If we looked at the interior cedar hemlock adjacent to the subboreal spruce, those similarity values would be higher. And initially, that's what would happen. You know, the climate would change gradually. And one where it's say a little bit less similarity was this boreal white and black spruce zone, where it's becoming mostly like the interior Douglas fir climate or a ponderosa pine climate. And here there's very low similarity, 10% to the ponderosa pine, 30% to the interior Douglas fir zone, and 2% in wetlands, 20% in wetlands here. And so that's obviously a much greater change. But would this even happen? I mean, the boreal white and black spruce zone is way in the far northeastern part of the province, interior Douglas fir type climate, and the ponderosa pine climates are in this very southern part of the province. It's a long ways for species to migrate, and there's a lot of differences there too. This just compares some of the similarities in tree species between those zones, the similarities and differences. So you read across the table here, and this is just comparing, say, then this boreal to the Douglas fir to the ponderosa pine areas. And aspen is pretty much in all of them, although much less in a ponderosa pine climate. It's mostly on wetter sites. Lodgepole pine in these two, not really in the ponderosa pine zone. Balsam poplar, a cottonwood in all of them. The spruce kind of changes a bit. No spruce really in the ponderosa pine. We have black spruce in the boreal, but not in the others. And of course, there you have ponderosa pine and Douglas fir in those two. So, as I mentioned, it's a long ways for those species to migrate. So even though the climate is very much like those in a fairly short period of time, it would obviously be quite some time before you would have those tree species migrating that far north. So what will we get when you think about it? You think, okay, we have a warmer climate and it's quite dry, and that's like this interior Douglas fir, ponderosa pine. It's hard to speculate exactly, but I think we could see a lot more aspen and lodgepole pine as a dominant part of the landscape, and probably an increase in sort of shrubby grassland type communities, which, you know, used to be more prevalent in parts of the boreal. So this sort of thinking about what we might get in the future and trying to think about what we might do about it is, in the BC Forest Service, we're calling the Future Forest Ecosystems Initiative. And what we're doing then is it's a fairly new initiative. It's just giving some thought to it over the last year and a half or so. And we started doing some climate change scenarios, of which I showed you some of already, some vulnerability assessments, and we're trying to consider how to adapt our forest management policy. So vulnerability is, as I mentioned, we're initiating a few assessments. It's basically the degree to which an entity is susceptible to or unable to cope with the effects of climate change. And you could look at the vulnerability for, you know, an individual, you know, species or person, a company, a community, a management unit, or the whole province or whatever. And we're starting to look at this for water, hydrology, soils, forest productivity, ecosystem. Just we're in the initial stages of doing these kinds of assessments. In sort of a very general sense, you know, what do we expect in, say, southern British Columbia? As I showed you earlier, it's getting warmer, as everywhere is, but it's also projected to get drier. So we expect an increase in disturbance risk, fire and other pests and pathogens. We expect an increased pressure on domestic water supply, changes in forest productivity in the sense that with more drought, there'll be probably lower productivity in a lot of areas, but then with increasing temperatures, we actually might get higher productivity at upper elevations and maybe even some increase in forest. Of course, there'll be increase of forest at upper elevations, loss of alpine, but then we get an increase in grasslands at the lower elevations. And in this landscape, there are quite a number of invasive species already, and there could be significant issues there. This is just a slide that was done by the Royal BC Museum, which shows kind of the grassland zones in south of us in Washington State coming up in these valleys, as I mentioned previously, in British Columbia. Here's a bit of a look at what some of our grasslands look like. And what's projected to happen by, say, the 2080s is a fairly significant increase in that. But trees, you know, are in grassland climates now, and they survive, and they sometimes try to encroach, and they get hit back by fires or whatever. And so in these sort of tension zones, there's always a bit of back and forth between trees and grassland. Well, what's likely to happen over this period of time is these trees will survive as long as they aren't hit with some sort of disturbance, like fire or some insect. But once that happens, of course, the balance changes to grasslands. The regeneration of these trees will be difficult. But what will also happen, say, with fires or something else hits that landscape, is there's a lot of invasive species. So even though we're heading to more of a grassland climate, are we really going to get a desirable grassland ecosystem? Or are we going to get more knapweed and other invasives that we don't really want? What I say, a knapweed, cheap grass, infested mess. But so what can we do about it? Well, mitigation is one thing. And we've all, I think, heard various options for mitigation from, you know, taking public transit, riding your bike, or whatever. And I'm not going to say too much about mitigation tonight. I'm going to talk more about what our adaptation options are. Basically, you know, one thing we can do is try to adapt the forest to the changing climate. And that's kind of the focus of a lot of this Future Forest Ecosystems Initiative. But there's also, societal adaptations. I think we need to adapt to the forest response in the sense that the forest will adapt, and to a certain degree we have to accept the consequences of what happens. We can't predict them all accurately, and we probably, even if we try different adaptive measures, probably won't get everything right. So to a certain degree we have to accept the consequences and where we can take advantage of the opportunities. And basically, you know, adapt our expectations and demands on our forests. In sort of looking at what might happen in the future and what our future forests may look like, there's a lot of uncertainty. And there's uncertainty, as I kind of alluded to a little bit, in the models, these general circulation models or global climate models, both terms are used, are fairly broad models. And when you bring them down to a fairly fine scale to apply them to British Columbia, especially to our very diverse topography, we're probably not going to, you know, they're not going to be very precise. What happens in the future depends on the emissions over the next decades, of course. Right now, the models do not give us a lot of information of extreme events, and that's what drives a lot of ecosystem processes. Now, I understand they are getting better, at least in predicting those. And as I mentioned, just the complexity of climates in BC and applying it to those. We don't know very much about the rates of migration for a lot of species, and as I mentioned, there are invasive species issues which we'll have to deal with. We're predicting sort of, like I say, increases in disturbances, but we don't know what that'll mean, and we haven't really. It's more difficult to predict what pests or pathogens, I guess, might come in to play. So, what to do? From a forest management perspective, what we want to do is undertake practices now that will kind of ensure forest products and benefits and services in the future. With an uncertain future, that is a little bit more difficult task. I sort of like to think of it, though, as designing an investment portfolio in the future. And in a high-risk environment, I think all of us would go for a more balanced portfolio and not try to put all of our eggs in one basket. So I think it comes down to sort of balancing our resource expectations from the forest and also trying to accomplish a variety of things on that landscape. So that's why I say we should try to be more adaptive, try more things on the landscape, because that will mean that if any one thing happens in the future, you've still got other things out there that are still surviving and adapting. And we have to have a policy environment, I think, where we can change policy quickly so that when we start to see something happening, and we have experiments out there that might show what's successful, we can change our policy quite quickly and make things happen on the land base. So part of that too then is doing modeling, scenario analysis using various ecosystem-based models to predict what might happen and to see what our adaptive responses could be. And I think we really have to have a very well-structured monitoring system. I mean, if we can't obviously predict everything that will happen, and so we have to have people out there in the forest monitoring and reporting back so that we know where things are changing and what's happening and so we can adapt. And what we're trying to do then is generate policies for more resilient ecosystems, being those that can recover from disturbance. They have the capacity to adapt to change. So how do we get resilient ecosystems? Well, there's a few things we could do in forest management. One is, reducing the vulnerability by fire management. That could be just trying to prevent forest fires. It could also be trying to restore certain stand conditions where eliminating fires has caused higher densities and this sort of thing. We can try to control pests and invasive species, so that reduces the vulnerability of ecosystems. And we can try and do what's appropriate for the disturbance regime, which Hamish just talked about. We can try to enhance the adaptive capacity by doing a few things, I think. And one is trying to maintain or enhance diversity. And we can do that in forestry through how we manage species on the land base. What species we plant, what species we harvest, and how we harvest, what we leave behind, this sort of thing. We can also, I think we have to think about species migrations and making sure that we have corridors for migration. And those corridors have to be linked to certain, I guess you might say, parks or reserves or areas where we have a lighter footprint, what I call here just genetic reservoirs, areas of species populations. And we may, in some cases, facilitate migration, especially for a lot of commercial tree species, trying to move species or populations to a future climate area, taking into account that they have to survive in this climate, but also be productive and under less stress in a future climate. And we may then also try to maintain ecological integrity where we can, but even restore it in some areas where it may be impaired. An example might be the big sage, bluebunch, wheatgrass, grasslands in the very southern part of the Okanagan, which are fairly high in invasive species. So those are some ideas of what we could do. And then we have to think about where we're going to do that. And then this is one of the challenges of scale and time. British Columbia is 95 million hectares, of which 62 million hectares is our forest land base. Of that, though, 38 million hectares is in what we call the non-timber harvesting land base. It's an area that we have no intention of harvesting at this point in time. And about 24 million hectares then is in the timber harvesting land base. And on any one year, we may harvest, a very small portion of that, a couple hundred 6,000 hectares, yeah. And so you think, okay, over 10 years, how much area could we change through our forest management practice if we were only doing it on areas that were harvested? And so it would take quite some time to impact even, you know, the whole timber harvesting land base. But you can see there's a much larger area that we are not really impacting through forest management at all. So I guess we have to ask ourselves, do we just restrict our adaptive measures to what we're harvesting in the future, or do we actually take some action on other parts of the forest? So this is where we get into, I guess, the part of the talk here where we think a bit about what is the role of the public then and in this, in sort of helping design, I guess, our future forests. Part of what we said already is that, you know, society, I guess, and we'll have to learn to adapt to the forest response. We need to sort of respect the way nature works, not how we might like it to work, and that's sort of thinking about the disturbance regimes. We can have an influence on the direction and timing of adaptation. So as a public, you know, you have a role in that because it'll obviously take resources to try to adapt the forest. And so how much is actually spent on that is a somewhat of a political decision, I guess. So there's an opportunity to get involved in decision-making processes. And I just put a few things down here about some things that we might think about. And one of those is like this water versus timber kind of as resources, just something that Peter Atwell just mentioned in Australia as well. And you think about the southern interior of British Columbia and the droughts that could happen in the future. So what is the value of kind of the water resource versus the timber resource, and what's the balance? And I think that's where the public you need to get involved in that dialogue. I also think we need to think a little bit about our parks and what they are and what we do with them in the future. If climate change plays out the way it's predicted, the parks probably won't function the way they were intended to function, which I think a lot of us wanted them to function, which is as representatives of existing ecosystems. That's the way they were designed and laid out across the land base. So obviously we can say, okay, should we try to protect the parks from what might happen? And how would we do that? How would we protect them from fire or pests? You know, have a huge scorched earth buffer around every park, and even that probably wouldn't work. So I guess we have to say, okay, are you guys going to let the ecological theater play out in the parks of British Columbia? And, or, you know, do we have to increase our parks in order to have these things? Or do we have areas where we have a lighter footprint, a forest footprint on the land base in order to, you know, help the forest adapt? The other thing I guess we might want to think about is we spend a lot of effort, I guess, trying to protect rare species and communities right now. And I think it's hard for me to fathom that we wouldn't lose species through the kind of change that's going to happen. And so I think what it'll come down to is we need to have some discussion then about, you know, what kind of resources do we put into trying to protect rare species when we know that we're fighting something here. How active do we get in, say, trying to move species or whatever? So those are the kinds of questions I think we need to ask. And when it comes to something like ecological communities, then it's even trickier, because the communities, the species will move independently somewhat from communities. And so trying to protect a rare plant community might be, you know, impossible. But I'm not saying it is impossible. I'm just saying that we need to have some dialogue around what we can and can't do and what our expectations are. So there's a few take-home messages, hopefully. One thing is, I guess we've tried to say that we need to respect the diversity of BC's forests, these ecological stages. You know, BC is very diverse, and as climate change plays out on all these things, we need to take into account that we have these different stages, and what might be a good idea in one area may not be in another. We try to make the point that succession plays out on these stages, that temporal diversity, you know, is something that's part of the ecosystems, that helps in their resilience and the sustainability of the forest. And, you know, we can't freeze the play in one act, as Hamish said. We want to let these things play out. And we want to understand and respect the role of disturbance and how it varies from place to place, so these different disturbance regimes. Although we didn't talk a lot about mitigation, I think, you know, we understand that we could all do something to reduce our footprint. And I guess what we feel is that some form of ecosystem-based management is likely the best way to adapt the forest to climate change in British Columbia.
That was Dr. Del Meiniger, a government forest ecologist with the British Columbia Ministry of Forests and Range. He spoke about the planning for climate change at the 6th North American Forest Ecology Workshop on June 19, 2007. This talk was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. You can find more free forest-related files for download at www.ecoshock.org.